content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We thank them for their support. Our first reading, On Common Ground, when members of the Choctaw Nation heard about a tragedy halfway around the world, they didn't hesitate to help. The Irish never forgot their generosity. Some 175 years later, the bond remains. This is by Richard Grant. And I have been to the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. On March 23, 1847, at a meeting in the small town of Scullyville in Indian Territory, Major William Armstrong, the U.S. agent of the Choctaw Nation, took the floor to speak. In attendance, gathered in a stone and timber building, were tribal members, agency officials, missionaries, and traders. Armstrong, reading aloud from a pamphlet, informed them about an event taking place on the far side of the Atlantic and of no obvious interest to the Choctaw people, the Great Famine of Ireland. The historical record doesn't reveal exactly what Armstrong said at that gathering, and so far, no one has unearthed the pamphlet distributed by the Memphis Irish Relief Committee. But the generous response of the Choctaw is well documented, and it has given rise to a seemingly improbable friendship between the Irish and the Choctaw Nation. In large part, the bond between the two peoples is based on their shared experience of colonization, mistreatment, and suffering. Many Irish were already living in harsh conditions before the famine. Seeing the extreme poverty in the west of Ireland in 1835, the French journalist and political theorist Alex de Tocqueville described a collection of misery such as I did not imagine existed in the world. By the time Armstrong addressed the Choctaw people, it was clear the famine in Ireland had been catalyzed by the failure of the potato crop that poor rural people depended on. The deeper underlying cause was that Ireland, colonized by England centuries before, had been forced into a land tenure system that enabled mainly English landlords to extract substantial profits from the Irish tenant farmers while leaving many of them destitute. For these poor rural Irish families, modest beds, chairs, and tables would have been the extent of interior furnishings, considered luxuries. Nearly half of them were living in one-room windowless mud cabins. Evicted and unemployed families lived in even worse conditions. They put roofs over ditches and burrowed into the banks, or lived in tough huts in wet, muddy bog holes. Tenant farmers raised grain crops to pay the landlord's rent. To feed their own families, the workers grew potatoes that were boiled and eaten at every meal, augmented by milk or buttermilk, and sometimes bacon and salted herring. Once the blight came, families were without a primary staple for nourishment. The British government was of little help. Charles Edward Trevelyan, a top treasury official, curtailed the government's subsidized food distribution program. even at one point rejecting a shipload of corn. Too much aid might paralyze trade, he wrote in a letter, and would leave the Irish habitually dependent on government. What a nice guy. Instead, in the fall of 1843, Trevelyan managed a public works program, arranging for hundreds of thousands of Irish, including some women and children, to build stone roads and dig ditches for a pittance. It's believed that many Irish people collapsed while working on the roads. Others huddled for warmth on unsanitary cabin floors, providing ideal conditions for the spread of typhus and other diseases. Historians estimate that more than 1 million Irish people died between 1845 and 1851, either from starvation or hunger-related disease, 1/8 of the population. Another 1 million people left Ireland, mostly to England, Canada, and the United States. The vessels that carried the disease-ridden and malnourished Irish refugees were known as coffin ships. That's the picture of the Great Famine we have today. The account provided 176 years ago by Armstrong, an Irish-American friendly to the Choctaw, despite being a government official, communicated that mass starvation and land evictions were taking place, and the Irish people needed help. The Choctaw were deeply moved. Some reportedly wept. Despite their own impoverishment, circumstances, and the recent disposition of their homelands, they raised either $174 or $710. The number is disputed. That's why I gave you the two numbers. The latter, the equivalent of more than $5,000 today. And that money was to help famine relief efforts. At the time of their donation, little more than a decade had passed since the U.S. government's brutal removal of the Choctaw from their homeland in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, and relocation to what is now Oklahoma, part of the forced migration of Native Americans that would be remembered as the Trail of Tears. On their new land, many Choctaw members were living in poverty, with inadequate housing and little access to food. In Scullyville, at the time of the Irish famine donation, several hundred Choctaw were camped around the government agency, hungry and destitute, and dying of illness, which only makes the tribe's generosity all the more astonishing. In the words of historian Annalise Hanson Shrout, writing in the Journal of the Early Republic, it's difficult to imagine a people less well-positioned to act philanthropically. The money collected in Indian Territory that day in 1847 went to Memphis and then New York City, where organizers wrote it had been contributed by the Children of the Forest, the Choctaw Nation. It was likely used to buy grain and other foodstuffs that were shipped across the Atlantic. Seven Irish newspapers published accounts of the generous Choctaw. Quakers, who played a key role in relief efforts, could have distributed the materials to the Irish. Then, for nearly a century and a half, the gift was almost entirely forgotten. The person most responsible for resurrecting the story of the Choctaw gift, as it became known, is Don Mullen, an Irish humanitarian, author, and filmmaker. Mullen and his wife, Marguerite, live in a semi-detached house in a modest suburban in South Dublin. I went there to ask them how it happened. During a traditional Sunday lunch of roast lamb, potatoes, and vegetables, he pointed to a portrait on the wall of Desmond Tutu, the late South African bishop and human rights activist who was a close friend of the Mullins. In 1984, Tutu came to Our Lady of Lourdes Church in Dublin, and he talked about children in the townships of South Africa drinking water to fill their stomachs. He mentioned that they starved to death in a country that exported food. A light went off in Mullins' head. He was struck by the parallel with Ireland in the 1840s. The only crop that failed in Ireland during the Great Hunger was the potato. Wheat, barley, corn, oats, and grazing land for livestock were all flourishing, but these were cash crops for export, and Irish people, even as they starved to death, were forbidden to eat them, Mullen says. Once shipment of grains and a variety of other commodities reached the Irish market towns, under the eyes of the hungry populace, they were often guarded by military escorts until they were safely shipped out of the country. Listening to Tutu and remembering this history inspired Mullen, as director of the humanitarian organization Action from Ireland, to create the Great Famine Project. He describes it as a marking or commemoration for the 1 million Irish who died and 2 million who ultimately immigrated. We put famine in inverted commas because we questioned the whole concept of famine, since there was no food shortage in Ireland, he says. Noting all the food that was being produced in Ireland and exported. Mullen was speaking about the project in upstate New York when someone in the audience approached him and said, "Did you ever get with the Choctaws? The Choctaws helped the Irish." Mullen had read Cecil Woodham Smith's 1962 book, The Great Hunger, which contains half a sentence on the gift. Now, sensing the power of the story, he started searching for more information. He tracked down the Arkansas Intelligencer, one of the first newspapers to record the gift, referring to the poor Indian sending his mite to the poor Irish. What moved him, Mullen says, was the context in which this happened, with the Indian Removal Act and the Trail of Tears. The Choctaws had suffered a horrendous brutality at the hands of white Europeans, and yet despite that, they could allow their humanity to supersede any prejudice they were entitled to carry. As it happens, de Tocqueville had witnessed that tragedy as well. In the winter of 1831, he stood on the riverbank in Memphis and watched a large band of Choctaw board a ship for the Arkansas side of the Mississippi River en route to Indian Territory. The cold was unusually severe. The snow had frozen hard upon the ground, and the river was drifting, large masses of ice, de Tocqueville wrote. The Indians had their families with them, and they brought in their train, the wounded and the sick, with children newly born and old men upon the verge of death. They possessed neither tents nor wagons, but only their arms and some provisions. Never will that solemn spectacle fade from my remembrance between 1831 and 1833. An estimated 15,000 Choctaw people traveled the Trail of Tears, a journey of more than 500 miles, and approximately a quarter of them died along the way. In In 1989, Mullen, determined to tell the story, produced a radio program about the Choctaw Gift for Ireland's National Broadcasting Service. Nobody knew about it in Ireland except maybe famine historians, he says. People were moved by it. The following year, Mullen visited the Choctaw of Oklahoma and thanked them for the gift. There was a lovely reception there, and I think they were as curious as anyone that this Irish person was on their doorstep. Although they didn't remember anything about the gift, it made sense to them. Mullen says, because giving and helping others is a big part of Choctaw culture. In 1990, he invited some Choctaw tribal members to lead AFRA's commemorative Famine Walk, which takes place every year in County Mayo, and they made Mullen an honorary chief of the Choctaw Nation. In 1992, Mullen decided to commemorate the Choctaw Trail of Tears by walking it in reverse. I did it with two other people, and when I did that, I first met Waylon Gary White Deer, the distinguished Choctaw artist. Mullen and White Deer became friends, and they have since traveled together on many speaking tours. In 1995, Mullen invited White Deer to Ireland to lead the Famine Walk. And in 1997, on the 50th anniversary of the Choctaw Gift, the Irish government commissioned him to paint a symbolic representation of the Irish Choctaw connection. On a bodhran, or Irish drum, he painted a Choctaw mother holding an Irish baby, and he donated his commission of nearly $14,000 to Concern Worldwide, an Irish aid and humanitarian organization. What motivated the Choctaw to donate to a people they didn't know thousands of miles away? At the time, some white people interpreted such generosity as evidence of the positive influence of their culture, of white culture, it says. They are repaying the Christian world a consideration for bringing them out of the benighted ignorance and heathen barbarism, the Arkansas Intelligencer said. White Deer dismissed that view as ridiculous. As I see it, you have one poor, dispossessed people reaching out to help another poor, dispossessed people, White Deer explains. We heard about another people who were suffering much as we had suffered, and so we must help them. Piece by piece, largely the work of Mullen and White Deer, a relationship has grown between the Choctaw and the Irish. It is founded on the story of famine gift and the shared experience of colonization, and conducted in a spirit of mutual respect and generosity. A plaque commemorating the gift is fixed to a wall in the Mansion House, the official residence of the Lord Mayor of Dublin. In 2020, when the Navajo and Hopi were among the groups in the United States hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic, the Irish donated nearly $2 million to their relief fund. It took off like wildfire, says Mullen. A lot of Irish people know the story now, and here were Native American people who needed our help. Larry Mullen, Jr., drummer for the Irish rock band U2, gave $100,000, but most Irish donations gave small amounts. Many also posted comments on the relief fund site. It's only fair, said one. Repaying an Irish debt, said another. We remember for kindness shown to Ireland. In 2020, when the Navajo and the Hopi were among the groups in the United States hardest hit by the pandemic, the Irish donated nearly $2 million to their relief fund. It took off like wildfire, says Mullen. A lot of Irish people know the story now, and here were Native American people who needed help. Larry Mullen, Jr., drummer for the Irish band. I'm sorry, I just said that, or Smithsonian made a mistake and double printed it. In 2018, the Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, visited the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. He made a heartfelt speech promising the act of kindness would never be forgotten, and he announced a new scholarship program for Choctaw students to attend school in Ireland. One of the program's recent beneficiaries is Austin West, who is a political science student who arrived in Cork in 2021 at the age of 23. It was West's first experience of international travel and one of the few times they had been outside Oklahoma or its neighboring states. And let's see, there's a picture here. Austin West visits Kindred Spirits, a monument to the Choctaw in County Cork. The 20-foot-high steel feathers symbolize those used in Choctaw ceremonies. And there's a full-page picture of the feathers. They're, looks like they're made out of metal, and it's they're about twice as tall as I am. West wore a shirt printed with the words Chata Sia Hok, I am Choctaw, as a reminder the spirit of the Choctaw community was with them. West's tuition and expenses were covered by the Irish government for a year of master's level study at University College Cork in the field of international relations and diplomacy. Exiting the airport in a cold, drizzling rain, West climbed into a taxi and then realized they had forgotten to withdraw euros to pay for the fare. The taxi driver was super friendly, but I couldn't understand a word he was saying, West remembers. I panicked, thinking everyone in Ireland would have a thick an accent as him, and I wouldn't be able to understand them. When the taxi driver started grilling West on Irish politics and social issues, Brexit, Afghanistan, religion, and Donald Trump, West tried to provide answers. We had to stop at a random ATM to withdraw euros, and I could barely remember my PIN, West says. He dropped me off near my accommodations, but I soon realized it was the wrong location. I stood there in the Irish rain, and it took about 30 minutes of comical confusion, walking through the puddles and the rain with my luggage, to find my accommodations. Then I collapsed on the bed. I ended the day by looking at that shirt, Chata Sia Hok, and being excited about what was going to come next. The following morning, after securing an Irish SIM card and phone plan, West walked to the main quadrangle at University College Cork and took a photograph of the emerald lawn enclosed by gray limestone, credentialed walls and arched buildings and doorway. I'm sorry about that. I couldn't get to my phone quick enough. We hit it off instantly, said Young a few months later as she sat with West in the cafeteria on campus wearing a traditional long Choctaw skirt sewn with ribbons and three-tiered necklace. And that was very interesting. I've been to Choctaw Nation and I've been to Cork, Ireland, and my wife's getting ready to go there now because she has kin there, and I am going to copy this article and give it to her. So, the students tell the story of the famine gift many times a week, and it often requires explaining who Choctaw people are and giving a basic overview of indigenous people in North America. My identity is definitely very other to Irish people, says Young. But there's a great interest and great compassion and a great will to learn. West and Young are both of mixed ancestry, something the two repeatedly explain to people. We constantly feel the weight of it, of not looking native enough for people, says Young. I haven't faced anything derogatory or presumptuous in Ireland, but I've definitely heard, oh, you don't look Indian, and oh, you don't really look Native American. Young is of mixed Choctaw and Irish descent. One of her great-grandmothers married an Irish settler, but she grew up knowing only her Choctaw ancestry, history, and culture. The Irish side wasn't really talked about in my family, she says. A lot of motivation for applying for this scholarship was because I wanted to come to Ireland and feel that reconnection with ancestors. It's very personal for me and sometimes very emotional. When she wears her regalia, as she calls the full-length long-sleeve dress with an apron and beaded jewelry, she attracts attention. At a hotel in County Mayo, a man complimented her outfit and asked about it. When she told him she was Choctaw, he clutched his chest and said, "Wow, welcome, thank you. I know about the gift. Thank you from our ancestors." Young had to make an excuse and leave because she was about to weep. West, I'm joking out myself. West regards the famine gift as a perfect example of Choctaw values. Compassion, giving, making sure everyone is well, West says. That, to me, is what being Choctaw is. My grandmother was constantly offering food, checking that people had enough to eat. The gift also reminds West of a traditional Choctaw story. Two hungry men go out hunting, and at the end of the day, all they have is one scrawny bird. They hear a woman wailing and go to her. "I'm hungry," she says. And on that note, we're going to have to wind it up. That's all the time we have. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's programming was underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. This broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. It's been my pleasure reading for you.